This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled The Lazy Law and Social Control. The police and the law are dedicated less to fighting crime and more to defending the social-economic status quo.
Let's talk about the law today. Through most of the history of labor struggle, law officers have been on the side of the bosses. Police have either looked the other way or actively cooperated when company goons and vigilantes attacked union organizers and picketers. In recent years, in various parts of the country, police have attacked striking farm laborers, truckers, miners, meat packers, janitors, and factory and construction workers, arresting and injuring hundreds. Many workers have been imprisoned for resisting court injunctions against strikes and pickets, and even for shouting at scab workers or daring to talk back to police while on picket lines. In Elmwood, Indiana, 7 strikers were shot by company goons. A striking coal miner in Harlan County, Kentucky, was shot dead by a gun thug, as was another miner in McDowell County, West Virginia, and a farm worker in Texas. In none of these cases did police apprehend anyone, despite eyewitness evidence of the identity of the killers. Working people generally have very little reason to be happy about the law, and they have a lot of reason to complain about how the law is enforced. The law and its enforcement agents do many worthwhile things. I'll grant that. I'm very happy to say that many laws enhance public safety and individual security. The police sometimes protect life and limb, direct traffic, administer first aid, assist in times of community emergency, and perform other services with commendable dedication and courage. But aside from this desirable social service function, the police also serve a class control function. That is, they must protect those who rule from those who are ruled. And they protect the interests of capital and property, big property, from those who would challenge the inequities of the system or those who advocate any kind of redistribution or reformist politics. The profiteering corporate managers, plundering slumlords, swindling merchants, racist school boards, special interest legislators, and others who contribute so much to the scarcity, misery, and anger that lead to individual crimes or mass riots, they leave the dirty work of subduing these outbursts to the police. When the police charge picket lines, beating, gassing, and occasionally shooting workers, they usually are operating with a court injunction that allows them to exert force in order to protect the interests of the corporate owners. The police confront dangers and social miseries of a kind most of us can only imagine. They deal with the damaged and oppressed products of a competitive, free market society, the ill-fed, the ill-housed, the desperate, and the defeated. The slums are not the problem, they are the solution. They are the way of dealing with the surplus people of a market economy. And it's the job of the police to sweep protests and poverty under the rug, even if it takes a gun. When directed toward social reforms that benefit the many, the law often appears ineffective. But when it's mobilized against political dissenters, the resources of the law appear boundless, and enforcement is pursued with a kind of vigor that itself becomes lawless. So, after a while, people learn that they're not as free as they might think. If they engage in progressive causes that challenge privileged interests, they risk being targeted for repression. One mechanism of repression is the grand jury, supposedly intended to weigh the state's evidence and protect the innocent from unjustifiable prosecution. The grand jury usually ends up doing whatever the prosecution wants. Grand juries have been used to conduct fishing expeditions against persons with unconventional political views, required to appear without benefit of counsel, without being told the nature of the investigation. Dissidents have been forced to answer questions about their political ideas, their personal associations, or face imprisonment for refusing. The upshot is to turn them into involuntary informers regarding any conversation or activity to which they have been privy. Another political control agency is the Internal Revenue Service, or the IRS, known affectionately to many of us, especially in mid-April. The IRS has gone after dissidents for purposes having little to do with tax collection. A General Accounting Office study found that some 28 civil rights leaders were audited repeatedly. The Communist Party had its assets seized and was illegally denied tax exemption for years, while the two major pro-capitalist parties, the Republicans and Democrats, or Demicans and Republicrats, as some people say, they enjoyed uninterrupted tax exemption. The IRS has investigated the Black Panther Party, Students for a Democratic Society, Socialist Worker Party, gay rights advocates, environmental groups, anti-war groups, liberal politicians, and many other politically oriented individuals, organizations, and publications. Not to get more taxes out of them or to keep them honest on taxes, but to harass them and use the tax laws as a way of hamstringing them. Loyalty and security checks have been used by government agencies to deny public employment to people of anti-capitalist persuasion. Private sector employees have no First Amendment protection from bosses who might fire them because of their political views. The right to political opinions, which, by the way, is a right in a country like the Netherlands, the right to have whatever political opinion you want without suffering deprivation or punishment does not exist in this country. Discrimination on the basis of race, class, or religious orientation is against the law, but not discrimination on the basis of your political views. The courts have ruled that the Constitution prohibits the government, but not private businesses or institutions, from suppressing speech. In other words, if your boss doesn't like your opinions about GATT or the environment or about minimum wage laws or about U.S. foreign policy, he can fire you if he wants to. People with affiliations to anti-capitalist groups have been hounded out of jobs in labor unions, academia, entertainment, industry, and various other fields by both private employers and government investigators. During the Vietnam War, protesters were attacked by police on dozens of campuses throughout the country and in major demonstrations in many cities. At Kent State, protesters were killed. In Orangeburg, in Jackson State, students were also killed. Many were wounded by police and guardsmen. From 1968 to 1971, police attacked the headquarters of the Black Panther Party, a Marxist revolutionary organization, in more than 10 cities. By the way, the Black Panther Party also was involved in breakfast programs, community help programs, and the like. In more than 10 cities, the police wrecked their offices, stole thousands of dollars in funds, and arrested, beat, and shot occupants in planned, unprovoked attacks coordinated with the FBI, attacks in which more than 40 Panthers were murdered by police in that period, including Chicago leader, Panther leader Fred Hampton, who was shot dead while asleep in his bed. The suppression of community activists is a form of counterinsurgency, a way of keeping people victimized. A Chicago community worker observed as follows. I quote from a letter she wrote to me. I remember the police harassment assisted by the FBI. If it were not for their cruel and unjust campaign, there would probably be a top-notch democratic community organization here, led by citizens groups and the Black Panthers. The leaders instead are all dead or in Marion Prison, Puerto Rican and black, and the Near West Side is still a disaster in spirit and physically. The despair that followed paved the way for drug traffickers to stake out the territory, and the feds helped them. To this day, kids are threatened from a very young age, and the family unit is fragmented by deplorable employment and housing policies. Unquote. So from a class control perspective, a demoralized, disorganized community is far more easily subjugated than a community operating with democratic unity and strength. You know, we're taught that in the United States there are no political prisoners. But in fact, we've endured a long history of politically motivated jailings. The great American labor leader Eugene Victor Debs and some 6,000 other socialists, pacifists, and radical labor organizers were imprisoned or deported during the First World War or immediately afterward in what was known as the Palmer Raids. That was the Attorney General Palmer just going around the country rounding up people whose opinions he didn't like. The anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested and eventually executed for a crime most investigators and historians say they never committed. These two immigrants were killed because they were anarchists. numerous African American leaders involved in progressive community causes and struggles against drug pushes were railroaded into prison on trumped up charges. Martin Sostre, Frank Shufford, Eddie Carthen, Ben Chavis. In many of these cases, the police actually planted drugs on the community organizer who was fighting drugs to railroad them into jail, where they suffered astronomical prison sentences, solitary confinement and beatings and other mistreatment. But in contrast, the police seemed curiously protective of drug dealers. Leaders of Black Men's Movement Against Crack in New York were spied on, harassed, arrested, and convicted of illegal possession of weapons, attempted escape, and assault, charges they repeatedly denied. Native American Indian activists Timothy Jacobs and Eddie Hatcher took over a Robeson County, North Carolina newspaper office one day to bring attention to rampant police corruption, drug dealing, racism, and murder by officials. Tried in federal court for kidnapping, they were acquitted. Tried again for the same action in state court, they were sentenced to prison for 25-year terms. There's the case of the Crips leader in Los Angeles, Dwayne Holmes, who brought peace between the gangs in L.A. and who was caught on trumped-up charges. Some provocateurs came to a community event that he was sponsoring and said that he stole $10. 20 witnesses said he did no such thing, and the police believed the provocateurs, arrested Dwayne Holmes. He had got a court-appointed lawyer who refused to call any of his defense witnesses. The lawyer was later made head of the Bar Association in that area, and Dwayne Holmes was sentenced to and is now serving 7 years in prison for this $10 theft, which he never committed. Prison inmates who propagate anti-capitalist or black nationalist views, or Latino nationalist or Puerto Rican nationalist views, who engage in prison protests, have been singled out for mind control programs. Prisoners like the socialist Stephen Kessler, charged with disrupting a federal penitentiary by, quote, promoting racial unity, collectivizing the inmate population, attempting to secure legislative inquiries into prison conditions, and being involved with outside radical groups. Now, all those things I thought were part of his democratic rights and sounded like some pretty good things, too, promoting racial unity. But instead, Kessler, for his efforts, was placed in a behavior modification unit to be subjected to mind-altering drugs, beatings, forced rectal searches, prolonged shackling, isolation, and other tortures. In the words of one Oklahoma prisoner, quote, "As long as prisoners confine themselves to gambling, shooting dope, running loan rackets, and killing each other, everything is fine. Let them pick up a book on Marxist theory, and they are immediately branded a communist agitator and locked in solitary confinement." In a class action suit, Warden Ralph Aaron testified that the special control unit in Marion Federal Penitentiary was used, quote, "to control prisoners with revolutionary attitudes and tactics." In the late 1960s and early 1970s, over 300 members of the Black Panther Party were arrested, many held without bail or trial for long durations. By long durations, I mean 2 to 3 years without a trial. At least 15 former Panthers convicted on fabricated evidence and testimony that was subsequently recanted are still in prison, some for over 20 years, including Panther leader Geronimo Pratt, who has spent 8 of his 23 years of imprisonment in solitary confinement. Pratt was charged with murdering a woman when he was a 21-year-old UCLA student and a Panther leader in Los Angeles. He was convicted on the testimony of a witness who was identified years later as a paid FBI informant. The FBI conveniently lost their surveillance records showing that Pratt was in fact 400 miles away attending a Panther meeting in Oakland, California at the time of the LA murder. An ex-Panther facing the death penalty is Mumia Abu-Jamal, a radio journalist and former president of the Association of Black Journalists. He's still in prison after decades. After repeated harassment from law officers, he was shot when trying to stop police from beating his brother. An officer was killed by one of the bullets fired. Abu Jamal was charged with the death, even though no weapon or ballistic evidence was ever produced linking him to the shooting. And he's still in prison today. In prison as of 1994, along with the Black Panthers, were former members of the American Indian Movement, including Leonard Peltier, who has been incarcerated for over 17 years. The Black Liberation Army members, members of the Republic of New Africa, a black separatist movement, Puerto Rican liberation activists, Irish nationalists, Chicano and North American anti-capitalist revolutionaries, community radical organizers, and peace activists. One Puerto Rican nationalist, Carmen Valentine, a housing activist, teacher, and organizer against police brutality, is serving a 98-year sentence for seditious conspiracy. Like his recent Republican predecessors, President Clinton has done nothing about any of these cases. Among U.S. political prisoners were the members of Plowshares, a peace group who jackhammered the concrete around a Minuteman missile silo in Kansas in 1984. For this protest action against nuclear weapons and demonstrating that, in fact, these weapons were first-use missiles, because they weren't solidified against an attack, they were going to be used as a first-line attack. For this action, these protesters, 11 of them, were sentenced to 18 years in prison. Still in prison is Barbara Kurtzey Lahman, a white working-class woman once active in anti-racist organizing in what she called an underground anti-imperialist movement. She was given 15 years for, quote, seditious conspiracy, and has been threatened with additional sentences of 265 years. Another white woman, Linda Evans, organized so effectively against racism that the Louisiana Ku Klux Klan put her on their death list. To protect herself, she purchased guns using a false identification. For this and for harboring a fugitive, Evans was arrested and sentenced to and is serving 45 years. Susan Rosenberg, a revolutionary advocate and former acupuncturist, was arrested along with an anti-capitalist associate, Tim Blunk, for weapons possession and false identification. Both were convicted of just that, weapons possession and carrying a false identification, and each was given 58 years, and they're serving that time right now, consistently being denied parole. Silvia Baraldini, an Italian citizen, was an anti-war activist and sympathizer of Puerto Rican independence and black liberation. Refusing to testify before a grand jury in the USA, she was tried for conspiracy and criminal contempt and has sentenced and is serving 43 years in prison. Along with Susan Rosenberg and a Puerto Rican nationalist, Alejandrina Torres, Baraldini was held for 2 years in the high security unit at Lexington, Kentucky, enduring windowless, unadorned cells, deprived of fresh air and human contact, and subjected to constant surveillance by a battery of cameras and hostile male guards. In time, their eyesight and health deteriorated. None of these people that I've mentioned, none of these people were ever convicted of assaulting or injuring anyone. Mark Curtis, a packing house worker, a labor unionist, and a leader of the Socialist Worker Party, was arrested in Des Moines, Iowa, and charged with having sexually assaulted a 15-year-old. He was severely beaten and knocked unconscious by police. The alleged victim said her attacker was 5 feet 6 inches tall, had smoke on his breath, and broke into her house. Curtis is over 6 feet tall, does not smoke, and was in a restaurant with a dozen other people at the specified time of the rape. After Curtis was convicted on the testimony of one police officer, one of the jurors presented an affidavit indicating that she believed Mark Curtis was not guilty and that she was one of four who voted for conviction even though they had grave doubts about the case. Curtis was sentenced to 25 years for sexual abuse and burglary, crimes he did not commit. During the Gulf War, some 2,000 military personnel were denied their requests for conscientious objector status and forced to go to war. At least 24 other service personnel refused on moral grounds to participate and were sentenced to military prison, some for as long as 6 years. A number of them were worked 12-hour days and fed starvation diets while incarcerated. In sum, political prisoners exist in the United States, and political prisoners receive grossly disproportionate sentences. They're routinely denied parole, even when qualifying for it, and are subjected to isolation, behavior modification, brutality, and other punitive treatments. Over the years, local and state police have worked closely with federal authorities to suppress anti-capitalist and other protest movements. The FBI devoted more effort to investigating the civil rights movement than to investigating the violence perpetrated against the civil rights movement. Those who engaged in the struggle against racial segregation in the South during the 1960s sometimes suffered physical assault and even death at the hands of white vigilantes, while police and FBI informants either looked the other way or actively assisted. Nowadays, police utilize billions of dollars worth of surveillance hardware provided by federal authorities against anti-capitalist groups and other dissident groups. In 1970, one police official declared that there were more law officers throughout the country, quote, on political intelligence assignments than are engaged in fighting organized crime. I don't doubt it. A RAND corporation engineer has speculated that, quote, we could easily end up with the most effective, oppressive police state ever created, unquote. In various cities, secret police units, commonly known as Red Squads, spy on and harass lawful advocacy groups, sometimes poking into the private lives of public figures to embarrass or pressure them out of public life. Red Squads have monitored hundreds of thousands of individuals and organizations. Perhaps one reason authorities cannot win the war on crime and the war against drugs, quote, quote, is that they're too busy fighting the war against political dissent. As part of that war, the FBI launched a counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO, which in effect is still in operation. It's designed to expose, disrupt, and misdirect members of progressive groups of any stripe. Working closely with local police red squads and private right-wing organizations, the FBI used forged documents, illegal break-ins, intercepted mailings, telephone taps, undercover provocateurs, and false charges. The Bureau has infiltrated various labor unions in attempts to brand them communist-controlled and has cooperated with management in the surveillance of strikers. In contrast to the way they treat the left, federal agents have done little to discourage violent right-wing extremist groups and sometimes have supported their activities. In San Diego, the FBI financed a crypto-fascist outfit called the Secret Army Organization, whose operations range from burglary and arson to kidnapping and attempted murder. The FBI organized 41 Ku Klux Klan chapters in North Carolina alone. Who is the FBI working for? Paid FBI informants in the Klan did nothing to stop Klan members and Nazis who committed murder and other acts of violence. This was true in Greensboro, where four radicals were murdered by Klan members who were assisted and directed by FBI undercover agents in the Klan. In some instances, the FBI informants assist the murderers by procuring weapons for them and directing them to the correct location where the murder is going to take place. U.S. military intelligence and the Chicago Police Red Squad jointly operated an organization called the Legion of Justice. Its members clubbed and maced protesters and anti-war demonstrators, broke into their headquarters, stole files, vandalized a progressive bookstore, and committed other acts of disruption and violence. In Chicago, after repeated death threats, Rudy Lozano, a Chicano union organizer and anti-capitalist who worked remarkably effectively to unite Latinos, African Americans, and working class whites around working class causes and issues, Rudy Lozano, this wonderful, many people called him a saintly man, he was shot dead in his home by someone who came to his door on the pretense of asking for a drink of water and who stole nothing. According to family members, paramedics who arrived at the scene thought they could save Lozano's life, but police blocked them from getting near him because, quote, evidence might be destroyed. Of course, the police never had a clue and never apprehended the killer. In instances of right-wing violence against the left, police rarely manage to catch the perpetrators. Political violence, as such, seldom bothers the authorities. It depends on who is using it against whom. Thus, when asked what they intended to do about the 15 or so right-wing paramilitary terrorist camps within the United States, a Reagan-appointed Justice Department official said the camps did not appear to be in violation of any federal statute. When two Chicano socialists were killed by bombs planted in their cars, the FBI made no arrests. When a powerful bomb wrecked the offices of several progressive and civil liberties groups in New York, injuring three people, the police made only a perfunctory investigation. After a series of threats, an anti-nuclear organizer was shot dead in Houston, and an assistant was seriously wounded. Police came up with not a clue. If this is democracy, who needs dictatorship?
You heard Lazy Law and Social Control, Part 5 in a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is the author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths. Here is a brief preview of our next issue of Radio Democracy.
Within the government, there exists what some have called the national security state. It consists of the president, the secretaries of state, the secretary of defense, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is the military heads of all the various armed forces, and numerous intelligence agencies like the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. The national security state often operates like an unaccountable sovereign power of its own. Its primary function is to defeat political forces that seek alternatives to free market capitalism, at home or abroad, or even forces that might try to introduce any kind of economically redistributive politics even within the existing framework. We often think that the United States is free of the kind of political crimes, assassinations, and death squads that characterize other countries. Well, think again. When agents of the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos conducted operations against Filipino dissidents in the U.S., the FBI cooperated with these agents. One known FBI informant admitted to having witnessed the murder of two Filipino union leaders who were prominent in the anti-Marcos movement in this country.
Michael Parenti coming up on the next segment of Radio Democracy. For a copy of this talk and one other by Michael Parenti, please send $4 for one cassette and ask for Part 5, Lazy Law and Social Control. For the entire 12-part series on 6 cassettes, send $24, that's $24 for 6 cassettes, to People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA. That's People's Video Audio, Post Office Box 99514, Seattle, Washington 98199, USA.